something I said yesterday. So he might point out that something I said about the symmetry group wasn't quite right. So remember that we had this two-knot bracket, which was twisted by this flux that we had in the back of this odd form. And so the symmetry of this, based on the formula that I put up, you can see the symmetry group of this is the set of all lithiomorphisms and hoop bounds. So it's like this. Such that when you pull back the free form and you take the distance, so when you look at how the flux changes, it actually changes by an exact amount given by that two point. So actually, the symmetry group is mapping to the lithiomorphisms, not the lithiomorphisms which fix H exactly, but just the cohomology class of H. And the kernel would be the, well, not the kernel, but the, this is like an affine space over the closed two points. So in the particular case where H is the zero flux, then this just becomes, this symmetry group just becomes semi-direct, closed two points, which lets the direct thing.
So H is closed.
H again is closed. It's the flux in the background. I was thinking it's closed.
So that means then that any infinitesimal lithium is, you know, the variation is in that. So
That's all right.
That's all right.
Yeah.
That's
right.
I mean, this is a huge enlargement.
Well, I mean, if there was no flux, then you would be allowed any lithium.
Yeah.
So here, this is actually cutting down something. It's saying that you're only allowed to change in the manifold, you're only allowed diffeomorphing the manifold as long as that cohomology class is fixed. But it's part of the flux. It's like fixing a, it's kind of like if you.
I understand. It's much bigger than I might have naively thought. That's
yeah, that's right. Kind of the thing that I put was the tiny thought. But that's incorrect. But I mean, you might, it depends on what level you want to do it. I mean, if you put a flux and say, I really want to fix that flux exactly for some reason, then you do that. But according to this bracket operation, the geometry that we're talking about, it's not important to fix it exactly. Okay. All right. So, having said that, I'll just. The main thing I want to talk about today is generalized Taylor geometry, which he already spoke a little bit about. So I'll review a little bit of what he said and go on from there. And then I'd like to talk a little bit about submanifolds. So special submanifolds inside a generalized Taylor manifold or inside a generalized complex manifold. What are topological ranges in the case of these generalized complex manifolds? Okay, so what is a generalized Taylor manifold? Well, remember that when we choose a generalized complex manifold, then this is the same as saying that we have an orthogonal complex structure on the bundle T plus T star. So T plus T star starts off as being an orthogonal space. And then we put this here, and then it becomes a unitary space. So that means that we're reducing from the orthogonal group of this even dimensional manifold down to the unitary group. Okay, and so, when I say generalized Taylor, for usual Taylor, what happens? You start off with your tangent bundle, which has GL2N structure group. Then you choose a complex structure, and it goes down to GLNC. Right? And then what you'd like to do is choose also a metric that's compatible here. So let's say a metric, a Hermitian metric. And then it'll bring you down to UN. And this is where Taylor lies. It's an integrable UN reduction. So here, I want to do something similar. I want to go down further here to the UN, cross UN. So this group is homotopically equivalent to this one. So this reduction, at least algebraically, is always possible. You can always reduce from here to here. You can do this by just choosing a metric on t plus t star, a positive definite metric, which is compatible with all the structure that you have up there, and then bring it down here to this compact. So this is where generalized Kähler applies. And then the question is, what kind of integrability condition? What does it mean to say that this is an integrable reduction for this for the structure group of t plus t star? And the key is just to realize that actually, if we choose two generalized complex structures, so suppose that we now have JA and JB, two generalized complex structures, then the first one, well, I'll draw this one. The first generalized complex structure brings you down to U n, comma n inside there. And the second one does the same thing. And you would like for the intersection to be this kind of U n cross U n. And this is doable if you assume that J A and J B commute. So this is the second thing that you need for generalized Kähler. So as soon as you found these commuting generalized complex structures, it becomes obvious what to require in terms of their integrability. We just want them each to be integrable. So this is similar to, in the Kähler case, saying that you have a complex structure and a symplectic structure. Okay. And then if we take a look at the generalized complex structures they determine, so here we have J, J, and here we have J omega, the symplectic one. Okay. So the fact that omega is type 1, 1 is the same as the statement that these two generalized complex structures commute. So this is an example of such a structure. We have two generalized complex structures which meet. Now there's an extra condition here for Kähler, which is that we want omega j to be positive definite. Okay, we want the metric that is determined, the Hermitian metric. We want it to be a Riemannian metric. So there's a positivity condition on Kähler. So what you require is the additional positivity condition that J1 is J2, or JA, JB, is positive. So what do I mean by this? Well, one way of saying it is that if I take the natural inner product of T plus T star, and say, or yeah, X, Y. This is a positive definite metric on t plus t star. Or if I just call this G, then what I want is for G to be a generalized Riemannian metric, like I defined in the first lecture. So, the way of writing this is just JAX, JBY. So, this condition is something that we're used to in the Kähler case, but it shows us that somehow we now have two generalized complex structures which are compatible with a generalized metric. Note that because JA and JB both squared minus 1, so we have G squared equals 1. Okay. And the plus and minus 1 eigenspaces, eigenbundles, C plus minus, are just the usual C plus minus that I defined in the first lecture. So these plus and minus 1 eigenspaces determine a positive definite splitting of t plus t star. So we have t plus t star, And then here we have C plus. I apologize for not using the same notation as you, but because if I change it now, we get great fees. So, right, so here inside C plus C star, we have this generalized metric. This generalized metric determines this splitting. And here we see that since this is positive definite and this is negative, this is where the UN is acting here, and this is where the other UN is acting. So when I say that this group is reduced to UN across UN, you shouldn't think of this UN as being the structure group of the tangent bundle, and this one as being the one for the cotangent bundle. What we have is that this Lorentzian space T plus T star is being split into positive and negative, and there's one UN and here's the other UN. So these are complex for JA and J for JB. Okay. Because if you just, JA and JB, they commute, and they obviously commute with their product, which is G, so they commute with G. So if this is the plus I eigenspace of G, certainly it will be sent to itself by both JA and JB. So that means that the complex structure JA or JB leaves this C plus invariant. So this is a complex subspace. So here we have a complex structure on C plus, and we have a metric, just gotten from the natural metric. So that defines us a UN structure here and another UN structure. So, all right. So right away we see that so what data do we have? We have this G, which, as we saw in the first lecture, corresponds to a Riemannian metric plus a two form. And then we said that we have this C plus and C minus and T and T star. And I said that C plus was a complex subspace, and so is C minus. But notice that since C plus is positive definite and T is null, this is the same argument that I used in the first lecture, the intersection between C plus with T or with T star has to be zero. So that means the projection here is an isomorphism. Okay. And the projection here is also an isomorphism. But the thing is that C plus inherits a complex structure from JA or JB, whichever one we want, because for the plus I eigenspace of G, you see that JA times JB is equal to minus one, so they're just negatives of each other. So they determine the same complex structure here. So there's a complex structure here, and then there's a complex structure there. And by using these projections, we can just push the complex structure down to T. Okay, so that means that in addition to G plus B, we also have complex structures, or I should say almost complex structures, J plus minus determined by pi of C plus minus.
In the case of a classical Kalin manifold, is the B here zero or omega?
No, definitely, in the case of, this is the metric, right? So in the case of a Kalin manifold, the metric is just the Riemannian metric. And the place where omega is contained is in one of the two complex structures, one of the two generalized complex structures. So here, if you took the product of JJ and J omega, you would just get something that looks like this, G inverse. So that this big G in the usual Taylor case would just look like this, just be the metric. Metric on T plus C star determined by the Riemannian metric. Okay, so what I'm saying is that we have these two complex structures. Now, notice, for example, that notice that because we have two complex structures, there are two sets of Chern classes here. We have two sets of Chern classes. CI plus minus, because we have two different complex structures. This is not surprising because this is a reduction to UN cross UN, so that means that the structure, the bundle, the principal bundle, if you want, is really a product of two bundles, which are both UN bundles. So you have two sets of term classes. They're independent. So far I've explained that we have, out of this data of a generalized Cayley manifold, we obtained two different complex structures. And it's obvious that because the complex structures are Hermitian on C+, so this was a UN structure, that there will be Hermitian here as well. So these are both Hermitian with respect to G. So the metric determined on C+, when you project it down to T, is just the same as this metric, and it agrees with the metric here. All right, so and then then you might ask, well, suppose I, at least algebraically, so far I'm not talking about integrability here, but algebraically the claim is that the pair JAJB is equivalent to the information GB J plus minus. And I've explained how to go this way by doing projections. And to see how to go this way, there's just a formula, which is JA. This is the formula that we wrote yesterday, but I'm just going to rewrite it in a way that might be slightly more clear. So here, I'm just showing you that if you want to reconstruct JA or JB out of a bi-Hermitian structure like this, okay, what you do is you just form this matrix. So this is J plus the sum or the difference of J plus J minus. These are the two forms determined by J plus minus G, omega plus minus, or G, J plus minus. Okay, so we have that algebraic correspondence between the data. And then the question becomes, what do you need to know about this data in order to guarantee that these two complex structures, these two generalized complex structures, are integrable? You know, these have to be Courant integrable in the way that I defined yesterday. And you want to know what does this structure have to satisfy? So if you want, so let's say JA, JB are integrable with respect to this Courant bracket in flux. If and only if, this is the theorem that we refer to, if and only if we have, first of all, J plus minus integrable complex structures, and also we mean that these are covariant constants with respect to connections, which are just the Legendre-Schmidt connection plus or minus a torsion piece. And here we see that the torsion for this connection is made up of the flux and this part of the Riemannian structure. Remember that we have this gauge symmetry, which was that B could be transformed to B plus B prime for any two form, as long as H could be transformed to H minus DB prime. So this quantity is gauge invariant. So these connections don't change if you apply a B field transformation to everything inside. Sorry, and these are supposed to be covariant constants. Okay, and these are exactly the conditions. This is what we spoke about. These are exactly the Gates-Hall work. This is exactly the geometry of a general 2, 2 model. So you see that, I'm not going to give the proof of this. If you look at the thesis for that, proving that this integrability implies this one is fairly easy. Going the other way is a bit more difficult. But just to see why the complex structures are integrable, say, it's very easy, because here we know that, let's see. So let me explain, it's important to explain why the complex structures are integrable. So we saw that T plus T star breaks up as C plus C minus. These are the definite decomposition. But we also know that T plus C star, when we complexify it, we have two generalized complex structures on this one. So that means that this will break up as LA plus LA bar, where this is the plus I of J. But remember that if this is the plus I of JA and we have this JB lying around, then if JB commutes with JA, then this eigenspace breaks up into the eigenspaces of JB. So this breaks up into LA plus LA minus, where this is a space where JB acts by, so I'll just write this way, LA plus LA minus bar. Okay. And I'll just write how the two complex structures act. And I'll also write G, how G acts. So JA acts on L by plus I, so it's plus I, and minus I on LA bar, so minus I. JB acts by plus here and by plus there, so it acts by plus I, and then it acts by minus I here. By definition, this is breaking up into the eigenspaces of JB and minus I there. And then G is just the minus the product of these two things. So it's going to be plus 1 on this and on this, and it's going to be minus 1 and minus 1 on this. Okay. So this bundle, when you have a generalized scalar, it breaks up into four bundles. So we have four bundles. And in particular, if we want to know what this C plus is, this C plus is just the plus 1 of G. So it's just the sum of these two. So it's LA plus LA plus bar. Okay. So this is just the sum of LA plus and LA plus bar, as in the diagram. Okay. So we can see right away the complex structure on C plus. So C plus is the sum of these two spaces. Right? And so the complexity, so that means that it's written as the sum of some complex space and its complex conjugate. So this is the complex structure on C plus. And so when we project the complex structure here, we're just projecting, so for example, let me write it this way. If we project LA plus onto the tangent bundle, I'll complexify it here, then we get T 1 0, we get the 1 0 space for J plus. So I'm trying to explain why J plus is integrable. Right? So J plus makes the tangent bundle split up into T 1 0 plus T 0 1 plus. So this plus I of this J plus is really the projection of this thing. But we know that this is just is just the intersection with LA with LB. Right? If you look at, here, then LA plus is where JA and JB both have plus I in this tangent space. And we know that both of these are integrable on the Fermat. Both integrable. So that means this is integrable. And remember that the tangent part of the Courant bracket is just Lie. So what we're saying is that we have this thing which is closed under the Courant bracket, and we're projecting it to the tangent bundle. But the Courant bracket is just the Lie bracket anyway, so that means this is going to be closed in the Lie bracket. So the idea is quite simple. I mean, we have T plus T star breaking up into four bundles. Each of those four bundles is closed under the Courant bracket. So when we project those things to the tangent bundle, they're all going to be integrable. That explains why these are integrable. Okay, but it's good that we have that decomposition because it's good that we have this decomposition into four spaces, because if we think back to the canonical bundle, right? Remember that what we did for a generalized complex structure was we said that, for a generalized complex structure, remember that what happened was that T plus T star, or let me write it this way, we had this L, which was a Lie algebra, and so we got a complex DL, exterior powers of the potent of the dual with L. And then we also have this canonical bundle, and we have this decomposition of the differential forms, sum of these wedge K of L bar applied to U. Okay. So remember that we have this complex on the Lie algebraoid, but then we also got a complex in the differential form, starting with the canonical bundle. It was like a del bar complex. So now, because this L bar breaks up into two pieces, right? So L breaks up into L A plus and L A minus. That means that we can decompose this thing even further. So we can say, start with U. Let's say we start with U A. Okay. So if we start with the canonical bundle of A, then we can apply L A bar to this. But LA bar is the same as LA plus bar and LA minus bar. There's always a plus and a minus component. So that means that this is going to get sent to LA plus bar UA. And another piece, LA minus bar UA. Excuse me. And similarly here, just keep doing this, applying L bar, but splitting the two pieces off, you're going to produce another space here, another one there, et cetera. And then down at the bottom here, this is going to produce something where if you add any more LA bar plus, it's going to get zero. So these are going to start coming down again. And so you're going to form a pod diamond, and this is going to be UA, the top determinant, so the determinant of LA bar applied to UA. This is the last line that you get. So you start off with a line, you apply L bar to it, and you get a larger space, which is the sum of two spaces. None of these spaces get larger and larger until you have a very large space in the middle. And they get smaller and smaller again until you get a line. So here there's a line. But at the tip here, there's also lines. So this line is exactly UB, the canonical line bundle of the second generalized complex structure. The way you can see that is you want to know, for a given point inside here somewhere, if you apply LA bar plus, you go this way, like this. If you apply LA bar minus, you go that way. And then if you apply LA, the complex conjugate to is LA minus. And then if you apply LA plus, you go this way. So if you want to know what this point is, just look that it's annihilated by these, this one and by that direction. So these two directions annihilate this line. And that's LA plus and LA minus bar. So LA plus and LA minus bar. The one that is plus I on that one is JB. So that means that it's annihilated by the plus I eigenspace of JB. And that's exactly the definition of the canonical bundle of JB. It's the thing which is annihilated by the plus I. So we have this Hodge diamond, but remember that this diamond is happening in the differential form. So this means that the differential forms is really written as the sum of these, what I'll call it UPQ, or yeah, UPQ. I can write the indices there. Or maybe the most. Okay. Let's do it this way. So P plus Q norm is less than or equal to N, and P plus Q is equal to N mod 2. Okay. See, I'm just labeling them so that this would be U minus N0. This one would be U N0, and this one would be U0 minus N, and this one would be U0. That's the labeling that is useful. Now, all right, so remember that in the case of the Kähler manifold, right, we know that the Kähler manifold has a PQ decomposition of its differential form. So you have the complex differential forms with a PQ decomposition. But the Hodge decomposition says that that decomposition holds in cohomology. If you take cohomology, then the cohomology actually breaks up into a sum like this of finite dimensional pieces. And then you have the Hodge diamond and the Fibetti numbers. So the question is, does it hold for a generalized Kähler manifold as well? Is there some kind of Hodge theorem for that? So the answer is yes. And we're going to see that that actually, if you do things using the language of generalized geometry, you obtain a proof of the Hodge decomposition, which is even easier than the usual one, the usual proof. Because the usual proof uses something called the Kähler identities. And in this language, the Kähler identities are almost obvious. So I'll just explain how that works. Okay. And the key to all this is to use the Bohr-Hittfeld metric that I defined the other day. So remember that this pairing on forms was defined using the star operation. And remember that star was reflection in C plus. So it was a product A1 AN of an orthonormal basis. It's a volume form for C plus. So this is an element in the pin group. Okay. And of C plus C star. And so this thing acts by the spin representation on differential forms. And I was using that to kind of modify the pairing of forms. So, but the interesting thing is that since this is reflection in C plus, remember what G does. The metric is plus one on C plus and minus one on C minus. Okay? So that means that G is as an orthogonal transformation, actually is minus one on C minus. So it's almost this. So this just means that when you map from pin to the orthogonal group, on, comma n, this star goes to minus g. So if you if you just look at this star is a product of basis here, so it acts by reflection. Here we have the reflection, just have to change the sign. But we know that minus g is equal to ja times jb. And so because of this fact, let's see, what can we decompose star itself in pin in the same way that we can decompose g. Right? So all we need to do is exponentiate. So these ja or v is actually inside the algebra of t plus t star. So all we need to do is exponentiate this. So we're going to get that star is equal to e to the pi over 2 ja times e to the pi over 2 jb. Okay, so all I'm saying is this. The way that the metric, so you know, when we say there's a metric on t plus t star, we say, okay, we have a metric on this metric bundle. That means the metric must affect the spinners in some way. It must affect the differential forms. So how does it affect the differential forms? Well, what you do, you lift the metric itself to something in pin, and then it's obvious how this thing acts on differential forms, because this is the spin representation. So now you see how this acts on forms. But the important thing about a generalized Kähler is that the metric itself is the product of the two underlying complex structures. So we want to take this thing and break it up, and this is how you break it up. So what this means right away is take a look at this decomposition. We can see right away that because we know that this is the canonical bundle for JA, and we know how J acts on these are just eigenspaces of JA, that means that it's very easy to figure out how star acts on these spaces. In particular, this is, so I'll show you this. UPQ is the IQ eigenspace for JA, JB. So you could explain it in different ways. This was the grading operator that he was talking about. He just wanted to remove the odds. But because we know that this decomposition is actually as eigenspaces already of the two generalized complex structures, then it's easy to see that this star acts preserving this decomposition. So this preserves decomposition. Well, in particular, the decomposition into the UPQ is orthogonal in the Born-Infeld metric. Okay, so using this metric I defined before, this decomposition is orthogonal. And so that means that now if we want to do Hodge theory, how are we going to do it? Well, the way you do Hodge theory is that you hit the exterior derivative. Right? You take its adjoint, you form the Laplacian, right? And then you act on the Laplacian and see if the Laplacian is preserving this decomposition. But because the adjoints of the operators are going to be computed using this star, so the adjoint was star d star inverse. Okay, because they're computed using this star, and because star preserves that thing, we're going to see that all the operators behave in the right way. So actually, one way of seeing this formula is as the Kähler of energies. Or maybe I should say Kähler of energy 1, and then Kähler of energy 2 will be the following. Or I shouldn't erase this.
Are you sure that this PQ is eigenspace of J and IP like you find?
Yeah, it's just because if you look at the canonical bundle, let's say this is the canonical bundle. Okay. Then
so JA and JB are complex.
They are, yeah.
Squares being complex.
first dimensional math, yeah.
But I just, let me say, I don't, maybe I'm not understanding.
Okay, so the, when I say that they're eigenspaces, it's a, what do I mean? So J A and J B, so J A is in the algebra of P plus C star. And then I have something which is a differential form. So this is a differential form. And now I'm acting by the Clifford action.
Okay, not as Clifford.
Well, there's no other way to reflect. It has to react by this action. Because these are spinners, and so there's nothing else for it to do. But if you want to see why, then if you write the matrix for JA in terms of the decomposition L plus L bar, then it's just minus I on L and minus I on L bar. Okay. So the action of this, if you remember, I said that when you have an endomorphism, the way that it acts in the spin representation is by minus A dual plus 1/2 the trace of A. And then if you look at how this acts on UA, you're just going to get minus 2NI plus NI. So that's why it's minus L eigenspace. It's it's a standard fact even with normal complex structures, right? If you have a complex structure, a usual complex structure can act on the differential forms just by dual, or it can act in a spin representation. So it'll act on the dZi's with adding everything up. So it, you know, if there's if you have dZ1, dZp, then some dZs, right? Then you're going to get a minus I from these. So it'll be minus pi plus q plus qi, something like that. So it's this action of the complex.
One action is if you regard this element of the algebra. The other action is if you regard this element of the group.
That's right, yeah. Except that in this case, you have no choice but to think of it as an element of the algebra, because this is not in GLT. It's strictly this. This is something that might have many components. So whereas in the complex case, it looks just like this, J minus J star, you could just think this action as a group element. But in this case, you have no real choice. OK, so but what I was going to say is that what I've chosen forward is that if you are at a certain point, then when you apply D, right, to this, so let's say you're at a certain place in the diamond, and we want to apply the derivative operator, exterior derivative. Well, if you think about just JA, right? Well, we saw that in the U, so L bar A U, in this direction, D splits up into two operators, right? There was a del bar and a del. But so those are with respect to A. But then in the vertical direction, there was also there's also a del B bar and a del B. So that means that this exterior derivative is going to map to only the neighboring cells. So really, where are the neighboring cells? They're like this. So these can be operators like this. And D will be the sum of all those operators. So D is going to be the sum of D. D minus. So that's what the differential complex looks like. And right, so so I just chose the notation so that it agrees with the action of LA plus bar. Right? So if it's LA plus bar to get from here to here, then I put delta plus bar. And then we have the Kähler identity number two. And this is the important one, which is So we have this decomposition into a diamond, and these are orthogonal in this Born-Infeld metric. Okay? So if we have an operator, we want to take the adjoint of this operator. So the adjoint will be going from here to here. And the Taylor identity is just saying that the adjoint of this operator is this operator, or to be more precise, the adjoint of this operator is minus d plus, and I'll explain why this is. So minus d plus, and then the adjoint of minus bar is equal to minus. Okay, so what I'm saying is that the adjoint of this operator is the negative of this one, and the adjoint of this one is this one. And those are the Taylor identities. So the reason that this holds is that, what does it mean to take adjoint? Well, adjoint is, remember, it's using the star, which is reflection in C+. And the star was reflection in C+. So this is the, if you look at LA plus bar, so LA plus bar is part of C plus here. So what this means is that we're reflecting, multiplying by minus one on C plus, and so this one gets a negative sign. Whereas the C minus is left by itself, so the adjoint here is itself. And that's a kind of hand-wavy explanation, but the proof is not much more difficult than that. And this, so again, remember that adjoint always means, whenever I take adjoint, it always means star D, star inverse. It's always, well, for these operators, that's what it is. So once you know that the four fundamental operators, and I mean, it goes without saying that because d squared equals zero, then we have all of these operators form a complex. So d plus bar squared equals zero. And then we have the appropriate commutation dimensions. D plus whatever bar d minus bar f to zero. Well, it's right more now. And then the key point is that once you've proven this Taylor identity, then all the Laplacians of everything that you, or all the operators in sight, any one of these four, or any one of these, or D, all the Laplacians are all there. So you just have to, I'll just write what that is. So the Laplacian D is equal to twice the Laplacians of del bar A or B, which is the same as four times the Laplacians of D plus minus that. Okay. Now I just want to make certain that we don't forget the fact that the integrability conditions was for a twisted chronograph, so we had this flux. So I just there's only one thing I forgot, which is that I forgot to put that this operator is DH. And the decomposition here is still unchanged when you have this H. So here we have DH. And these are all twisted operators. Okay, so once you have this fact, so usually in the case of Taylor geometry, you say that since we have a decomposition and the Laplacians of the decompositions agree, that means that the cohomology decomposes. Okay. So in this case, the same thing will happen. So the twisted cohomology, so here I'll put even or odd, because the gradient is just set to, the twisted cohomology of this generalized Taylor manifold breaks up in this PQ decomposition. So that's a kind of generalized function. So it's the twisted cohomology that enters, not the positional cohomology. And I just want to mention that, so the, in the original paper of Gates, Paul and Rochek, right, what did they do? I mean, they said that a general n equals 2 comma 2 model had had the structure of this bicommission geometry. Now, they knew that it has n equals 2 comma 2 supersymmetry because they started with 1 comma 1 and wrote the model and then imposed these conditions. Right? But the representation of the 2 comma 2 algebra was not obvious. It's not clear, you know, what are the complexes, the differential complexes on which the supercharges act. Okay. So the reason that they couldn't see it is because they were using a decomposition into the eigenspaces of Gibbs plus minus. And the problem is that these don't commute. I mean, J plus and J minus are two almost independent complex structures. Right? Whereas if you reinterpret it in terms of JA and JB, the things on T plus T star, they do compute. And so the decompositions that they imply on the differential forms, they preserve all the operators in sight. So here we have the four operators, which correspond to the four supercharges in the theory. So if you want to see what the supersymmetry is, you have to decompose in the right way, and this is the way to decompose. Okay, so all right. So, are there any questions about the way that generalized Kähler manifolds have a decomposition of their cohomology? All right. Well, what I'll do is I'll leave the subject of maybe there's one more thing to say, which is that how does the generalized so now we say that we have a generalized Kähler manifold. And we have two canonical bundles, UA and UB, canonical bundles. And so we could ask for some collateral conditions to hold. We could say, you know, can we find, is this homomorphically trivial? What about this one? And if they both are, so if UA and UB are both homomorphically trivial, so by homomorphically trivial, I just mean that special class, their classes inside the Lie algebraic homology vanish. Not only that, but I mean, not only C1 of UA equals C1 of UB equals zero, but also their homomorphic classes vanish. If they're both homomorphically trivial, that's the same as calling this a generalized collabial metric. Geometry. Okay, so this is the definition that we use for generalized collabial metric. Now, the important thing to realize about such a metric geometry is this. Let's say we have generalized collabial structure. And this is actually something I think that Strominger knew in the 80s when he wrote Super Strings of Torsion. He was aware of this work of Gates and Rochek. He was aware that if we make this additional constraint, you're going to run into a problem, which is the following. Well, it's not a problem, but it's a reality, which is that I think if suppose that we're in the canonical bundle, so we're at the corner of the Hodge family. So if we have a section, suppose we have a non-vanishing section of UA, which trivializes, which means D rho equals zero. So this is what it means for JA to be collabial. It means that we can find a trivializing section which is closed. Now, if we look at the operators, what that means is that, there is nothing on this side, we're at a corner, so what that means is that the sum of these two, this one vanishes and this one vanishes. Right? So in particular, that means that if we take the adjoints, well, I mean, it's kind of obvious that if we take the adjoint of D, then the adjoint D also vanishes. So that means that this implies that D star is rho equals to A, which means that rho A is harmonic with respect to this little fossil. Now, if we have rho A and rho B harmonic, then the following thing happens. And here I'm going to put a warning, so caveat. This is 95% proven. I'm not sure about this, so I don't want to say that it's completely true. But if these are harmonic, then what happens is if we take the pairing of rho A and rho, So here we want them both to be harmonically trivial. And we want them to have, there's an extra condition to be generalized Clausian metric. So also, we want the two sections that trivialize, so sections of, so, or I'll put trivializations of U, A, and U, B. Okay, if we take their norm, so rho A bar, we want them to have the same length. So this is the same condition as in the Calabi-Yau case. This is the same condition as requiring that omega wedge omega bar is equal to a constant times omega to the n. The constant, complete, a universal constant. It doesn't, it's not a function. It's just a constant. Okay. So we, this is important to the generalized Clausian condition. But if we take the norm of A, which is the same as the norm of B, then this inner product, because rho A and rho B are harmonic, it's possible to show that, well, let's say this is equal to some function times the volume form of the metric. So remember, this is something where we take rho A wedge the reversal of rho A bar, right, and then take the top degree. This is going to be something which is a volume form times some function. And remember, 95%. What happens is that the Laplacian of b to the f is equal to the norm of h plus db times b to the f again. And then okay, but then what this means is that if we integrate this over a compact manifold, this will be zero. And so that means that CB is the vanish, which means that H is exact. So, in particular, what that means is that that these two connections are actually just a repeated connection. And then we get back to a usual Taylor manifold, more or less. My only point is that there is a, so this generalized Calabi-Yau condition, right, you can interpret it in several different ways. If you interpret it in terms of JA, JB, this means that UA and UB are trivial. But you can also interpret it in terms of the J plus minus, right? And what this means is that these will be have a trivial determinant. So there's going to be Calabi-Yau structures for this J plus minus, right? And we're going to be getting what is it called, a torsion this is something that Mariana will probably talk a lot about in a week from now. Torsion SU3 structures, or SUN structures. So these are not, these are torsion SU3 structures. But then you can also reinterpret this. These are sections of the canonical bundle, so they determine the Riemannian spinners. Let's say phi and psi. And you can then recast this data, the metric and the B field are still there, but now instead of giving J plus, just give the spinner that it determines. So phi and psi, Riemannian spinners. And this determines supergravity solution. And this is what I mean when I say that it's been known for a long time that the 2,2 geometry of Bateson Rochek was known to give, in certain restricted cases, these supergravity solutions. And here we have a no-rule theorem, which is exactly this argument that I'm giving here. There's no difference. It's saying that if you have too many harmonic spinners or parallel spinners with respect to these torsion connections, then it's going to constrain you to get off of the compact manifold. But maybe you should view this as a kind of a guiding principle and not a complete proof. It should be finished in a short time. Did I start a little bit? Okay. So let me, if there are any questions about generalized collabiat structures. There are solutions to these supergravity solutions in the literature, more and more of them with these kinds of fluxes. And you can, out of this data, reconstruct a generalized collabial structure with the generalized Kähler, underlying generalized Kähler structure, and find out what these structures are. And I think that's what Mariana will probably be discussing.
So does that mean that they have to be non-compact?
If it's usual Kähler, then of course they can be compact if they're usual collabial manifolds. But I think that maybe the right way to say it would be that there aren't any interesting generalized collabial manifolds which are non-compact. But generalized Kähler, there are plenty of examples. In particular, actually, I should mention this. So the generalized Kähler is a very rich. There's a very rich source of compact examples of generalized Kähler manifolds.
So basically, in order for H to be non-trivial, or some the other way around, the generalized Kähler for them to have non-trivial H plus has to be non-trivial.
You have to be careful that it's generalized Kähler metric. You want the Kähler condition on both J and JP. But for generalized Kähler, I intended to give this example earlier. If we have a G being even dimensional, compact
U, from both E and U be at least double-edged for the trivial means both U on vector and U on axial are
simple. Right. And also there's this B or S C anomaly which vanishes.
Yeah.
There's also
more energy solving.
Yeah.
So that's this condition for this both U and R for left and right U and R existing. So that's the condition for conformal invariants.
Right.
So it's only
if
there's no
flux. Yeah, well, that's assuming that you don't put some other kinds of fluxes, which is what Mariana will talk about. You put more than one flux or something.
And oriented.
Yeah, something like that. That's something
that I'll but as long as you just put the wall sheet.
Yeah. Okay.
Ordinary wall sheet.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes.
But you've also assumed that double comes true.
Well, this because this is implied, then we get that this is, then the dual tone will be harmonic, and so it's compact. It has to be constant.
F is a dual tone.
Whether it's F or B to the F, I don't know which one we'll know.
So it's conformal and the central term is critical. Then the other thing is
in the compact case.
And
well, but it could be a harmonic function.
Well, if it is just conformal to there's a perfect wall sheet, it's great definition. There's no rule for the dual thing to be non-conformal, but it's available. Many of the other things are associated with off critical.
Yeah, critical in Colombia, so I have to
the central charge is not the right.
You want to see
it? Yeah, and if it is six follow action. Maybe you can also show some. I guess you can show that the central charge is the dimension. And if it's six dimensions, then it's but that has to be shown.
Nice.
Anyway, I'll get back to you on that. Okay. So if you have an even dimensional compact Lie group, then there always exists left and right invariant complex structures on this space. And let's call them J, L, and JR. Usual complex structures, integrable complex structures on this group. You can see this just by taking the algebra and finding a decomposition of the complexification, which is closed in the Lie bracket. This is always possible. So if we have this left and right invariant complex structure, and then we take the metric to be the, let's say, the bi-invariant Killing metric, and we take the flux to be the Cartan freeform generator for H3 of the group, then this forms a bi-dimension geometry, which is, it satisfies the right condition. So it's J up. It does satisfy this condition. And so on a compact Lie group, you can produce, using that formula, there's no B field in this case. If you just take JL plus or minus JR, and then omega L minus plus omega R, etc. This will form a generalized Taylor structure on a compact Lie group. So that's just an example of one of many possible generalized Killer structures. And the other interesting thing is that although this is left invariant, this is right invariant, these complex structures, these generalized ones, are not going to be invariant in either direction. Okay, but they will display some bizarre behavior. For example, you could have, if this is manifold, if you look at JA, then if we consider the type of JA, the type number can jump. So you could have curves inside the manifold or surfaces where you have, suppose there's JA and JB, the two generalized structures. One of them might jump here, and then the other might jump on this other space. Okay. So there are many kinds of behaviors like this where type jumping can occur in one or the other or both, and it's important to analyze kind of what happens at these locations. One way to see where these things will jump is the following. So there's an identity that the type of JA, and if you sum the type of JB, then this is given by 1/2 of the dimension of the kernel of the J plus minus kernel figure. So we have J plus and J minus, okay, complex structures. They don't commute. Okay. So the thing that measures how far they are away from being commuted, because this tummy figure. Okay? And if you look at the kernel depth, then this dimension tells us something about the sum of the types. Okay? And not only that, but also for vanishing flux, or for cohomology of the flux zero, this, if we invert indices here, let me just put g plus minus, is holomorphic by vector. So we have this, which is endomorphism, just raise the index to make it a bi vector. This will be holomorphic, and I'll put plus minus here, because it's holomorphic in both j plus j minus. So right away, you have a very strong condition which says that the tensor which measures kind of this this lack of commutation is actually holomorphic in both j plus and j minus. So that, for example, in the Hopf surface, say, suppose that we were looking at the Hopf surface, which is S3 cross S1, well, it's not semi-simple, but it still satisfies this condition. If we look at the Hopf surface, the anti-canonical bundle is wedge 2 of the tension bundle. So this is where this tensor lies. So you can say that G J plus minus is a section, holomorphic section of wedge 2T. But such a section vanishes at two, well, for, let's take a standard Hopf surface, at two elliptic curves. Okay. So just to give you a sense of what happens.
I'm a little confused about what generality you're making these statements in, because you were talking about the compact
Well, no, sorry, this is a general statement about any generalized Taylor manifold with vanishing flux.
Okay, which won't happen in that example.
You're talking about...
The compact lead loop, the canonical freeform...
I understand. This statement had to do with whether this is Poisson, so this is still holomorphic even if there is flux. I was thinking about whether it was Poisson, but this is not generally a Poisson bivector, but it is holomorphic. Okay. So in the case of a Hopf surface, one of these sections of the anticanonical bundle vanishes along two elliptic curves, if you want that. And that's where the kernel of this J plus J minus jumps. So this thing jumps, which means the types here are going to have to jump. So there exists a generalized Taylor structure on the Hopf surface, which is just the one that I wrote down with the left and right invariant complex structures, which is type 0, 0 outside these two elliptic curves. So JA has type 0 and JB has type 0. But then at this elliptic curve, one of them jumps up to be type 2, 0. And then on the other one jumps, where it becomes 0, 2. So this is just an example of how the jumping phenomenon in a generalized Taylor manifold is very tightly controlled. You can't just jump like crazy. It has to jump along a holomorphic divisor, and also the extent to which they jump is not independent. You have to make sure that they jump in such a way that they're still satisfying that condition. Okay. Right. Okay. So that's about all I wanted to say about generalized Taylor geometry. One of the big topics that I haven't spoken about yet is special submanifolds. So I'm kind of out of time. I think Guy will talk about some special submanifolds, or if you want to continue for another 10 minutes, I can talk about submanifolds. But I think I'll end it there. Yeah, okay. So I'll consider that as a question. So do I'm never sure how careful you are about time on these lectures. I have a feeling that you sometimes they go on for like 5 hours. Okay, so I won't say very much, but I'll give you the basic idea. So what about submanifolds? Okay, so if you have a submanifold inside N, and suppose this has some flux, and we already we said that whenever this has flux, it determines a special subclass of submanifolds, such that what we want is for the pullback of the flux to be given by to be zero in the cohomology event. So we want it to be df.